You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, is Emmanuel Macron the new president of Europe? My guests Carlotta Rebello, Chris Lord and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Turkey's attempt to mediate between Qatar and the rest of the Arab world, Donald Trump's apparently increasing reliance on family and friends, and much though Rio loves its carnival, should the city also be paying for it? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle's Carlotta Rebello, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chris Lord. Welcome all. It has been conventional wisdom for many years, but especially during the premiership of Angela Merkel, that the Chancellor of Germany is the de facto president of Europe. Might that be about to change? Specifically, might a tilt towards Germany's traditional counterbalance, France, be looming? Following his extraordinary surge to France's presidency, Emmanuel Macron and his brand new En Marche movement now look set for a thumping majority in France's National Assembly. We should, of course, I guess, remark before we start talking about France versus Germany on the passing of Helmut Kohl today, in the last couple of hours, in fact. Chris, first of all, the relationship between the two countries now, are they, as I think people have become accustomed to thinking of them, sort of friendly rivals at the heart of Europe?
Yeah, I think they are, and it's not as recent as even when Macron was in the presidential palace. I think if you know, this question ultimately about who's going to be taking the lead in Europe between France and Germany all comes back to the fact that there's not quite the synergy between these two leaders that I think people would like to imagine. You know, we talk about Macron as this sort of centrist power, young, dynamic, he's sort of out there, he's representing freedom and European values and so on. And quite often we talk about Angela Merkel these days in a similar way. But actually, if you look back in the run-up to Macron taking power and the way that they go in completely different ways on certain key questions that Europe has right now. I mean, the question of Greece, for instance, and the whole different way that Germany sees that Greece's many financial foibles should be handled and the way that Germany sees that Greece should be coming in, France and Macron himself, who wanted to see debt relief, who wanted to see those bailouts been bringing in for Greece. I think there is going to be some key distinctions between the two. And I think, you know, I think a little bit there is a feeling here of people buying into Macron fever a little bit too soon. You know, we've not even had the legislative elections yet in France and not actually seen what his cabinet's going to look like.
Well, indeed. Well, the legislative elections haven't concluded. We've had round one, I think. Mm. Round two is due presently.
June 11th.
Fernando, the sort of Macron mania there to which Chris alluded, is it an entirely positive thing? He has, and by positive I don't mean good, I mean is it a positive embrace of what he stands for or a rejection of everything else?
I actually am starting to believe that actually, you know, it's an embrace of Macron in a way. Of course, you know, in the second round was a rejection of Marine Le Pen's ideas. But, you know, and some people compare him, you know, with Tony Blair, Bill Clinton. And to be honest with you, I don't think that's such a bad thing because I think he comes across as a very sensible man. He's very much pro-market, but at the same time, pro-immigration. And as Chris said, has a different approach to Greece as well, which, to be honest, is that what I believe instead of what, Ms. Merkel believes. So I think I'm a bit of a Macron fan these days as well.
There are two points I'd like to make on this. One, touching on your remarks at the top of this. It's interesting, I know it's too soon on Macron's presidency, but of course, if you look at a comparison with, for example, François Mitterrand and the relationship he had with Kohl, and that was the epitome of the relationship between these two nations. And I think what's interesting is how at the very heart of it, Helmut Kohl and Mitterrand were pro-Europe, Europeans more than anything else. And I think Macron has been in a very long time the first person to hold this position that is evidently pro-Europe too. Hence, I think, why this question looming in the horizon if he's going to be the new president of Europe. In another note, touching on what you were saying about Bill Clinton and Tony Blair's comparisons, there's a trap here in a way, which is presidents or leaders, premiers, that become more famous abroad than they are actually at home, which was the case with those two as well, for a great part of it. They were recognized internationally. Everyone loved them and couldn't understand how the country that they governed didn't reflect those views. And I think that with Macron, if he's not careful, he might easily fall on that trap as well.
Chris, one of the reasons the EU was established in the first place, of course, was to create a mechanism which would stop France and Germany kicking lumps out of each other at regular intervals and pulling the rest of the continent into the scrap with them. There is, of course, about to be a rebalancing in the EU, with the UK still apparently determined to leave. Is that likely to make France and Germany more competitive or cooperative, do we think?
I think, well, first of all, your point about keeping them from attacking each other, first of all, yeah, I mean, that was the origins of it. But also, the EU's foundation was a market exercise. It was about an economic process, ultimately. And I think, actually, if you think about it, really, what the question of the EU now basically is, how far is it going to go? Is it going to become a super state? Is it going to become a federal, you know, United States of Europe?
Well, especially if the UK isn't dragging the chain anymore.
Precisely, exactly. So that seems to be the question to me is, you know, is what to what? And Macron, if you listen to some of the things that he says, he sounds like a federalist. He sounds like somebody who wants to see greater integration and see it become much more of a sort of, as I say, United States of Europe. I think, just coming back, one point, Carla, to me, I think it's very true about this idea of we more famous or more liked overseas than you are back home. I think one thing we have to remember in amongst all this Macron fever is that less than 50% of the French voters came out to that vote that brought him to power. That is not a mandate for the whole country. That is not the whole country turning out overwhelmingly to say this man is the one we want in power. There are going to be people who reject the centrism that he stands for, because the far left is still a powerful voice in France. And also, regardless of the kicking that Marine Le Pen got at the polls, the far right is still a power there. So he doesn't have that overwhelming thing, I think, that we possibly would like him to have, to be that all-singing, all-dancing man of Europe for the future.
But I think in that aspect, his strategic move of appointing his prime minister from the opposite party was quite a good one. You know, having a president and prime minister in what the French call cohabitation is not a novelty, but often doesn't happen when there's not a party pressure to make sure there's no uproar among the population afterwards. Macron didn't have to do that. It was so clear that he was the winner, but I guess it's his centrist approach of, I'm here evidently to represent everyone, and maybe thinking about the point you just made, who the amount of people that actually elected him and put him in this place, I think it was a very strategic move that could prove to get him more votes than from other fringes of the electorate.
I would agree with that. And also, I think as well, it's been very powerful on his side, which is a good thing. And this is a good thing about Macron, is that in these legislative the legislative elections that have gone on, we've seen all these political novices coming out and forming, you know, getting people behind them, going out into the streets and meeting people. I think for the French, that has been very positive, because it is a group of fresh faces that they're seeing for the first time in a long time politically in that country, and that is very powerful.
The average age of Macron's MPs is actually 43, yeah, compared, I think, the other parties about like 60 or 70. I mean, I think he's bringing something new to French politics in a way.
I mean, I've got terrible issues with the idea of people younger than me being in positions of authority, on the grounds that I still got absolutely no idea what I'm doing. And I certainly didn't when I was a mere stripling of 43. The final thought on this, Fernando, before we move on, is there still anything to be gained at all by thinking of France and Germany as either actual or potential rivals? Is that now officially entirely over, never to be resurrected?
I think so. And you know, to be honest, you know, the fact, I know we discussed this a bit earlier in the talk, but I think the fact that the UK is leaving, I think will make both countries closer. You know, if they want to defend the European Union, I think it makes sense. They wouldn't be as daft to continue with some sort of rivalry.
Well, let's look slightly further east now to Qatar, which is still languishing under a state of semi-blockade following a choreographed flounce by several of its fellow Gulf states and certain of their friends in the wider Middle East. As the standoff enters a second week, Turkey, in the person of Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, appears to be positioning itself as mediator. Mr. Cavusoglu has this week visited Kuwait and Saudi Arabia in search of solutions to a crisis which he says cannot be resolved with embargoes and sanctions. Chris, is there a certain amount of diplomatic theatrics going on here? Wasn't this only ever about just slapping Qatar around a little bit to demonstrate that they could?
Absolutely. And I think Cavusoglu's arrival into into the Gulf this week is absolutely a continuation of that theatre. I'm sure that Turkey is a little bit worried that it may possibly even face a bit of Saudi wrath too. Like, let's not forget, Qatar was one of the big supporters of the political opposition, of the opposition in Syria. They've supported the opposition in Libya as well. Turkey has done very similar things in Syria as well. I mean, if you look, they have helped. First of all, I mean, they led an incursion into Syria, supporting directly with armed support rebels fighting against, in some cases, Islamic State, and even some cases touching on fighting with the Kurds as well. I think this is theatrical, and I also do think that this whole process of Qatar being put into the diplomatic cold is there to show every state in that region that if you don't toe the line with this sort of kind of aligned Cold War movement that's sort of happening in that region with regards to the Gulf states and Iran, this is what will happen to you. And I think that is a message as much for somewhere like Oman that refuses to sort of align itself with the Saudis or the Iranians too strongly in either way, as even those states within it, like the UAE. Remember, we're watching. If you get too close to a state like Iran, if you get your fingers in too many pies and overtake us diplomatically, this is what can happen.
On that score, though, Carlotta, one of the responses we did see from elsewhere in the region was supplies being flown into Qatar by Turkey and, interestingly, by Iran. Qatar, the people who run Qatar are not fools. They will have been aware of the diplomatic signal that was sending to their tormentors. Is it possible that they might just have just pushed Qatar further towards the embrace of Tehran?
I think so, because, you know, when you look at the region, and they knew exactly what was going to happen with these sanctions, that Qatar couldn't continue without food and supplies. They have to get them in some way. And that was easily the way to turn. I love that story about 4,000 cows being airlifted, cows bought in the United States and in Australia.
Just being like airlifted. Any story with cows in it just becomes automatically
funny. And it's the biggest airlift of cows to a country that has ever happened. That's one of, the funny sides of this all. But it's really no surprise that Turkey has come to the rescue here in inverted commas of Qatar. You know, the two countries have had, you know, a strong military partnership. Turkey has a military base in Doha, the first, if not the only one, only base in the region. So is it really a surprise? I think it was more surprising that Kuwait wanted to intervene as a mediator than this.
Mm, absolutely. And also we have to remember as well that Turkey is an Islamist government. The Erdogan regime is fundamentally a religious, political, nationalist movement. Of the cuts are very similar to the kind of groups that Qatar has directly supported in Egypt. And, you know, let's not forget who was the sort of most worried party when Mohamed Morsi went to prison in Egypt was Erdogan, because he was worried that it was going to be tied against Islamist movements in that region. I think I think Turkey now, despite all this and talking about peace and wanting to bring people to the table, I think also they're a little bit concerned. If Saudi Arabia is still a key ally for them, they need them, and I think they're a bit worried about what might happen if they continue what they're doing.
Just to follow that up, Chris, the bit from Mr. Cavusoglu during his tour of the Gulf, which I did think was quite cute of him, was that he said that the isolation of Qatar was against Islamic values. Now, that's quite a way to talk to Saudi Arabia.
It is quite a way to talk to Saudi Arabia. I was quite surprised about that, too. I mean, I suppose in a way it's sort of... I guess Turkey would quite often like to... Let me say one thing. I mean, his point about Afghan Islamic values, I think, is just a bit of a nose tweak towards Saudi Arabia a little bit, if I'm really honest with you. But I think there's one point to be made about the similarities between Turkey and Qatar here, is that you've got to remember that Turkey, for a long time, has pursued this foreign policy of what they call neo-Ottomanism, which is going out into its old backyard, as it used to run in the days of the Ottoman Empire, improving relations, funding things like airports, helping them with, you know, logistics, da-da, all these various different things that it's done. That is not unlike what Qatar has been doing, ultimately. And we don't know the extent to which Qatar is, don't we? We still don't know. We don't, so much of this stuff has gone on very quietly behind the scenes. And the same goes for Turkey. We don't know actually to what extent they are involved with things like Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood or or what sort of alliances they have. I think it's a very important moment, this Qatar thing, because it does just show you the power that Saudi Arabia has in that region at this moment to turn the tide against a state. And that is so powerful. That's power in many ways beyond what the US has in that region at this time.
Fernando, has it at least been a useful corrective, I think, to the idea that we can often lapse into that the Middle East is one vast, undifferentiated leviathan full of people who all think exactly the same thing about everything?
I think so. To be fair, I'm not an expert on the region, but I find that this whole story very, you know, very strange. And I wonder, you know, because, you know, I'm quite of a little bit of a World Cup expert. You know, they're also hosting the event 2022. I wonder what's going to change. I mean, for how long those kind of sanctions will... For example, Chris, how do you predict? Do you think this will continue for the whole year? Or?
It's a very good question, Fernando. It really remains to be seen. I don't know whether they're going... what would it take for them to change? Their involvement, their fingers are in so many dangerous and strange pies here that to actually start unpicking that would be... I mean, it would be a complete reversal of so much policy of Qatar. Mm. And in fact, in many ways, you know, it seems such from different worlds, but the hosting of a World Cup and the amount of money they poured into their bid is not really in its soft power desires and wishes and what it's trying to achieve. It's not so far from the support it gives to things like the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas and so on through Al Jazeera and otherwise. It's, you know, it's a very strange game they've played to try and claw back some relevance and importance in a region so dominated by Saudi Arabia.
Turkey was one of the countries trying to get in, I'm not sure if it's sponsorship or with construction companies, into the World Cup as well. Mm. Just a tie between the story you were saying of how the foreign investment from both countries in the region, and that the World Cup is a particular example where you see Turkey and Doha at play.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Carlotta Ribello, Chris Lord and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up next, Donald Trump has had another one of his ideas.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Carlotta Ribello, Chris Lord and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And let's look now at the United States, where the day upon which President Donald Trump finally reconciles himself with his destiny and makes his horse a senator appears to have come a day closer. Casting about for someone to head the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in New York and New Jersey, Trump has lit upon one Lynn Patton, an events planner whose CV highlight is arranging the wedding celebrations of Eric Trump, the marginally less objectionable of Trump's two awful adult sons. Fernando, first of all, what do we deduce from his obvious preference for hiring friends and family?
I mean, it's a very weird decision, but again, not very surprising. And the interesting thing is that, you know, Lynch doesn't have any experience in housing. So
I'm thinking of writing off for a job.
I mean, I wonder, you know, I'm sure she might be a very good wedding planner, but, you know, to house, you know, such a vast area as New York City with a budget of billions... it is quite weird. And I think all the New York tabloids of today, they are also, you know, in despair.
But I think that's it epitomizes what's been going on with the Trump White House. Put aside, you know, appointments of people that you might not agree with, policies, etc. In his case, it's the first time that at least I can recall or remember from what I read that you have departments with 100+ open positions and no one is applying for them. And you have senior staff reaching out directly to someone saying, I want you to come and work with this person or that one. And they're saying, no, not under this administration. A job that for anyone that wants a career in politics or in policy making would be almost the peak of your career, to be working under the President of the United States, and you have people refusing to do so. So it is sad, kind of to quote Trump, I guess, with a lot of exclamation marks, that you have to resort to your son's wedding planner to fill in a position that is the biggest in terms of urbanization and housing in one of the most complex cities of the country.
But I mean, I suspect, unfortunately, I'm disbarred from holding high office in the United States because I'm not an American citizen. But if you were, I think the chaos and the febrile nature is such, Chris, that there is opportunity there. If you got an internship at the White House this week, you could be Secretary of State by the end of July.
But I think it'd be one of those like toxic jobs on your CV. You know, the one that people say, why did you do that?
Do you get the sense, Chris, that Trump is, I am projecting, that he's just past caring at this point? He's just thinking, I've got to appoint someone to this. Who was that woman who arranged Eric's wedding? Fine, call her.
I think so. There's a possibility of that.
How hard can it be?
I think also there's a little bit of a feeling as well that, you know, there's so much going on now at the moment with the Comey and with the investigation over Russia and so on, that really, you know, you can kind of get away with this weird stuff at the moment in a certain way. You know, I mean, there's this, it's such a strange decision that has happened here. I think also as well, you know, a guy who's made his money or his family's money in real estate and in the, in what a lot of people would argue, some of the most grotesque changes to New York's real estate market in terms of pushing poor people out of neighborhoods that they lived in for a long time and redeveloping them in a certain way amenable to very, very wealthy people. It's a little bit shocking, isn't it, that the person he brings into power, to look after housing, is someone with such a nepotistic flair. You know, I mean, I find that very, very grotesque.
And let's remember, no experience whatsoever. Because, you know, even, you know, if she had some experience, he could say, well, I know her. I know she's a talented person in this field, but that's not the case.
And it's not just experience. The Daily News today had is casting some sort of doubt over her education as well. She said she graduated from a university, the School of Law of that university. I can't recall the name. But it seems that the journalist, after ringing the university up, just said, yes, she attended, but we don't recall she graduating.
Details.
Yeah, I think there's a whole narrative here of trying this. In any other given presidency, this would have been a scandal, something that would have rallied people up. But the way things are going, we know by now that this is not a normal presidency. And I think, yes, there's a lot of other more important issues that are obfuscating all of this. And to add to the list you just mentioned, there's also the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act, which is trying to be done behind closed doors. It's right to ban the press from covering it. And I don't know to what extent isn't it all to distract from it. I just want to add a point on Lynne Patton. It's not the first time we've seen her. She spoke at the Republican National Convention and presented as the vice president of the Eric Trump Foundation. And it was a short 2-minute speech.
Sorry, I realize none of this is funny, but it kind of is.
But she, and for me, and apologies if this is not political correct, but she, it was the token African-American in the campaign. That was the purpose of her speech. She came out to say, decrying the attacks, you know, and police violence. I think it was right after the Orlando shooting as well. So decrying those attacks, talking about Baton Rouge and the Black Lives Matter movement, and ended a powerful speech by saying, you know, who cares about all this? Donald Trump, vote for him. Look at me, I'm a minority supporting him. She used these words. So I'm sorry, I just don't see that being genuine at all.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look to Rio de Janeiro, where the city's mayor, Marcelo Crivella, appears to be contemplating what might have been supposed uncontemplatable, cutting by half the subsidies allocated to the city's famous samba schools, in which Rio's carnival is rehearsed. The mayor wants to spend the money, not unreasonably, on the face of it, on improving Rio's daycare centres. Fernando, first of all, Mr. Mayor is not a party kind of guy, is he?
No, he's a bit of a populist. He's a former bishop and a former singer as well, a gospel singer, I must say.
Not a carnival kind of singer?
Not really, and in fact...
We're not going to see him gyrating in spandex on a float.
No, unfortunately not. No, and I have to say here, because this year, of course, is the first year of him as a mayor. He was not in Rio during Carnival, and that shocked many Cariocas residents from Rio, because, you know, as a mayor, you know, that's the biggest event in the city in the year. Mr. Crivella, you know, he went on a quiet holiday. And of course, some people speculate because of his religion. He's like an evangelical, and I don't think the evangelicals deal very well with Carnival in Brazil. So, there's this contradiction there.
Is what he's doing here, is it out of genuine, pure-hearted concern for Rio's children and the quality of their daycare treatment, or is this his way of expressing his own dislike of the carnival?
I don't think it's genuine at all, and I think, you know, he cut by half. It's quite a lot. So it's not that he, you know, of course, Brazil's in austerity. You can, you know, you can say that perhaps we should spend a little bit less. But to cut by 50%, I think that's quite a lot. And I have to remember, those samba schools, you know, they're not sponsored by big companies sometimes. Sometimes they're made by favelas, by communities that doesn't have that much money as well. So I think that's why the state needs to help sometimes this parade. Because Carnival, of course, is very rich. We have those VIP events. But that's that money is not going to the favelas, and I think the money from the government is. So that's why I am not very happy with this decision.
Now, Chris, as a general principle, should government subsidize, underwrite large public events like Carnival? If they are that big a deal, shouldn't they pay for themselves?
You know, when I read about this story, maybe it was a bit naive of me, but I was amazed that it didn't pay for itself. I mean, this is the most famous carnival in the world. It's bigger than anything, it's far bigger than Notting Hill Carnival, for instance, of which is an extremely profitable and lucrative thing. So I'm amazed that, first of all, it doesn't pay for itself, and that also there's even sort of a quibble about the government paying for it. But then what Fernando is saying is right. I mean, it's all well and good, sort of me sit here imagining, oh, of course Rio should have its carnival. But then Brazil has some super pressing problems when it comes to, you know, as you mentioned, favelas and daycares and so on, making sure people's quality of life. And so, you know, it just amazes me that there hasn't been, maybe that's part of the spirit of Carnival. They don't want to commercialize it too much. They don't want to get it to be able to pay for itself. But I was very surprised. But then I suppose, you know, there are pressing problems in that city.
Carlotta, where should a government prioritize between bread and circuses?
Well, circuses is important to keep spirits up. I think you need to have people motivated, and you know, Brazil is a country that likes to have their spirits up. I do understand the point here about you know, the money should be diverted elsewhere, but there is also another aspect to this that I don't know much about this mayor to say if that's at the core of any of his decisions. But the Rio Carnival is disliked by a lot of people because of what Brazilians call jogo do bicho. So it's kind of the illegal betting and trackers on which school is going to win, which one is going to perform best. Because it is a competition between all the samba schools. And sometimes, yes, it's professional ones, and others are small community favelas, and they prepare the entire year for this. But that game on the side, jogo do bicho, means that it's kind of money laundering exercise almost happening with Rio's carnival, trying to buy out certain schools, etc. Obviously, this is not the main part of the carnival, is a celebration, but this is also an underlying problem of such a big festival as this. So I don't think this was behind his reasoning. I think, it, as Fernando said, it has way more to do with personal beliefs. But I think it's a matter we should address as well.
To be fair, you know, if he cuts the funding, I think there will be more money laundering. I think there will be. I think it will become worse. And for now, it's suspended for next year. I'm sure you'll come back, but it'll be fine.
I hope so.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Carlo Rebello, Chris Lord, thank you all very much for joining me here at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hanzadeh Achakalan. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next at 1900. I believe it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and I'll be back with more in the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.